Welcome back to Make Me Data Literate. I'm very excited today to be delving into the area of STEM education and rigorous evaluation of programs, which is something, bizarrely, I haven't talked about yet on the podcast. So I think this is going to be really fun. And my guest today is Jake Clark. Welcome, Jake.
G'day, Linda. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited for this conversation. And I know it's probably going to go on tangents, but I'm excited for those tangents. I'm so prepped for them.
Me too. The tangents are always where it gets interesting. So tell us, who are you and what do you do?
So my name is Jake Clark, and I work as a principal evaluation advisor for CSIRO's education and outreach team. And so CSIRO's education outreach team is the National Science Agency's education arm, and we're supporting young people all across Australia to build their STEM capability. And so as a part of my role, I work in this sort of space of data science and research and evaluation to try and better understand why fewer students are choosing STEM in their tertiary education and in secondary education, and then also working out what works when it comes to STEM education programs. There's so many great initiatives out there, and so it's a matter of like, how is it working, and more importantly, who is it working for and who is it not working for, and so we can better work out better ways to engage young people in their education and to expose them to better STEM pathways. And then also, when you go and collect all this information and find out all these amazing insights, then it's a matter of, as we were sort of discussing before, sometimes the bit of the boring bit, but the most important thing is writing it all down and then being able to share and showcase that evidence with the broader STEM outreach ecosystem. So whether that's people like yourself, Linda, who are working in the sort of STEM space and trying to work out, well, how do I, what's the best way to engage teachers in terms of building up their capability or capacity in data literacy, or it could be around, you know, what are the best ways to embed inquiry-based workshops into regional schools, or how do we bridge mentors, industry mentors into low SES classrooms, or whatever the case may be. So it's a matter of being able to find out what is working and for who, and to bring I think of it as a sort of rising tide, and always try and be a strength-based approach as best you can, because we're all trying to do, especially in sort of STEM education and outreach space, where people are so passionate in this ecosystem, and sometimes it's a bit challenging to work out what is and isn't working. And so to be able to have the space and energy to be able to do that, to then say, hey, look, you're doing amazing things. What we might need to do is a little bit of tweak here and there, and bring that all up, because in some instances, smaller organizations don't have that capability or have that energy or have that person that they can just dedicate to do all this, to do all this work. So I'm very excited to be a part of CSIRO's education outreach team to be able to do all that as my day-to-day job.
That's so awesome. I love the idea of evidence-based education innovations, because I talk about that all the time, that so often schools implement new programs or they get very excited about a particular technique or a particular approach, but the capacity and skill to actually properly evaluate it is often missing. So it's really exciting to see.
Definitely. And I think what we need to understand is, particularly with the work that we have been doing and the exciting work that the impact and evaluation team, which I'm part of, is doing, is looking at the ecosystem as a whole and what we could do differently, is thinking about what works, why is it working, and what is the evidence base for that? And then, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, like, who is it actually working for? And particularly in data, you'll get like a sort of a single number that says, oh, well, confidence in math has increased by 30%. And you go, okay, well, that's cool, but is that significant? And, you know, is that because of who you've actually been delivering that intervention for? Is it the fact that you've been able to deliver that intervention to schools that already have that capacity, or the teachers are already on board with that type of pedagogy that they can then instill that confidence in them? Or is it the fact of, we have been specifically targeting teachers who don't necessarily have the background or skills, and we can see government reports that, you know, a lot of teachers are teaching out of field, and so not having the confidence and self-efficacy to then teach and be confident about what they're teaching. And then so that then also, I wouldn't say ooze, because ooze doesn't sound right, but then kids can feel that. Kids can feel that confidence. Yes. And go, well, if you're not confident, then how can I be confident within my own, within myself, and be able to be confident in these skills? So, you know, if you're targeting these specific people for this specific purpose, then that's great. But then your evidence should be showcasing that and go, okay, well, going back to that sort of single number, oh, well, that's great. But if we actually split this up into teachers that have low capacity, who have had low capacity before, or high capacity, actually, it seems like this intervention is working as intended, and the low capacity teachers have like a twofold increase in their confidence as opposed to the higher capacity ones, because they already had that sort of baseline to begin with, or whatever the case may be. So again, it's about sort of working out like why is it working, and who is it actually working for?
That's a super important insight as well. The idea that something that works in one school or with one teacher isn't necessarily going to work with other teachers or in other schools. And that idea that context matters, and oh boy, the teachers teaching out of field thing is such an issue. It was actually one of the things that shocked me the most when I moved from academia into teaching, was this idea that teachers could be asked to teach anything at all and without any qualifications. And indeed, in digital technologies, that's so often the case, because we just don't have enough people with digital technologies qualifications to fill the position. So it's a really interesting problem, particularly because they don't do that in all of the other countries. So France, for example, I know doesn't, because I have friends in the teaching system there, does not allow people to teach out of field. It's just not a thing. They don't do it. So it's obviously a solvable problem, but we certainly haven't solved it. It raises some questions, I think. Okay, so moving right along. What did you have to learn to do your work, all your evaluation stuff? Was that something that you came to the job like fully equipped with from your formal education? That's a big no on your face there.
No, and previously listening to Laura and Helen speaking about their experiences and the sort of non-linear pathways that they've come to in order to be in their roles, and I'm sort of in a similar boat. And so my background's actually in astrophysics and astronomy. So my undergrad, I went to University of Adelaide to do a Bachelor of Space Science and Astrophysics, and was really excited about that. And so as a physicist or an astrophysicist, you're sort of like a glorified computer programmer and data scientist, and sort of apply that to sort of astronomical stamp or lens. And so that really sort of taught me about data modeling and being able to grab sort of, I wouldn't say clean data, because data is never clean. And so you have to then work out why is it behaving, or why is it looking like that, and being able to sort of correct the data based upon sort of, especially with my background, your sort of physical constraints that the universe is dealing with, right? However, with social science data, the world is a lot messier. And as I tell people, like, finding planets around stars is so much easier than this type of work, because people's backgrounds, their values, their interests, who they are as an individual, all of their experiences,
plus just what kind of day they're having, you know.
Exactly.
You think you might figure one person out, but no, that can change from moment to moment as well.
Exactly.
I would say Technology is easy, people are hard.
100%. And so there's all that complexity, and then I go off and say to someone on a Leichhardt scale being, you know, rate something from 1 to 7, 1 being really bad, 7 being really good. How is that? Or, you know, people trying to condense down their whole life experience and understanding into this one little number is bonkers. But that's what we do. And so when I got the amazing opportunity to do a Fulbright over in the States and to work on machine learning, which was really, really cool, and to look at using a technique sort of similar to Netflix, when, you know, you watch some great TV shows and then it keeps recommending the same things. And we're looking at, well, if we can look at the, especially with astronomy, you're looking at, it's an observable science. You know, you just get what you get. You point your telescope out and then hope that you get to see something cool. And if you don't, well, that's just part and parcel of it, right? And so we were thinking, well, could you be a little bit smarter with the current data that we have and sort of forward predict what types of planets are likely to find around particular stars because we have the physical or chemical properties of it. Unfortunately, it sort of was null and void, and in terms of there wasn't anything conclusive. And so I came back home, and particularly during COVID, and so it was pretty hard to be like, well, let's get a job in research. I mean, it's difficult in the best of times because people are so clever in that space. And I got the opportunity to go back to Questacon. I actually did my master's with Questacon and ANU with a Master of Science Communication.
And oh, nice.
Which was amazing. I got to travel around to different parts of Australia doing science shows in the Questacon Science Circus. And they're like, hey, look, we need someone to look at the evaluation data for like a month. Would you be keen to come back and use your skills? And I was like, yeah, no worries. Like, would love to do so. And then that month turned into 3 years. which was absolutely amazing. And my manager, Jenny Booth, is a fantastic mentor. And so the work that obviously was missing a lot from my formal education, because I mean, I've evaluated in terms of I would run programs up at USQ where I did my PhD and run workshops to get kids to build planets out of Play-Doh. And ask them sort of evaluative questions around, did they enjoy it? Sort of more like program quality control type stuff, but never in terms of the work that I do. So I learned a lot in terms of formal education through my mentors and networking. And I mean, Stack Overflow is your best friend. Especially in data science, in the best of times. And so I think with the great opportunities I've had with the mentors that I have had in the sort of evaluation space, because again, you know, I come from a quantitative background, and then you're also dealing with a lot of qualitative research as well. And I'm so glad you had the likes of Helen on to talk more about that. And that research is incredibly complex and difficult and so subjective, and all research and all data is subjective to a degree. But it's really difficult to have something set up in a qualitative manner that you have a sort of control for or a baseline. And again, with the work that we do... kids are all coming from a different background. You have different interventions coming in and out. And so that baseline is so hard to be like, okay, well, if you come in, do an hour long intervention, are you actually moving the needle? Type thing. So I think in terms of what was missing from my formal education, it was that more qualitative data collection. And I think with a lot of formal education, you understand you get taught a lot of the theory of how things work, but not necessarily the soft skills of how you communicate with people, especially if you're doing an interview as we are right now. How do you get people comfortable in the space that you're in for them to actually give you an honest opinion about something without guardrails on or hackles up? Because, oh, well, what are you actually going to do with this information, and how is that going to be reflective of me? And so that sort of stuff that you just got to learn through experience for better or for worse, but definitely those types of soft skills are incredibly valuable, and stuff that you sort of learn as you're plodding along.
I think they can be taught, though, and I think we don't do a good job of that. You know, every university I've ever looked at says we do, you know, group work so that we teach our kids, our students, to collaborate and to communicate. And while they all do group work, very few of them seem to actively teach the communication and the collaboration. They're just like, we'll throw them in there and hope they don't drown or kill each other. And anyone who's done a group project at school or at university is probably sitting there listening to that at the moment, just kind of teeth clenched, fists tight, thinking about what a terrible experience the group work was. And it doesn't have to be that way. We could be teaching it, and we could actually be fostering much better communication skills. They do it quite well often in primary schools. They have, you know, communication circles and a whole lot of different techniques, but we haven't let that filter through the rest of the education system.
Oh, no.
I think you might have pressed a button. No. I get a bit angsty about that.
No, you're fine. And I think it's also when in that space, what is often missed out on is when you are in academia and someone who's come from that space as well, is that you don't get taught how to teach people. Or if you want to go into high school and be a high school teacher or a primary school teacher, you have to do a bachelor's or even a master's that's in some places to be qualified as a teacher. And similarly, and then when you are a tertiary educator, it's like, well, you're great at this research, so therefore you get thrown in. And this person who hasn't had that formal qualifications or training, they get put into out of field, and they get put in an out of field world, and they go, all right, here you go, sink or swim. And being able to sort of cut that cycle of, hazing isn't the right word to use, but being able to give people proper training and bringing people along for the ride. And again, like, what does a good group projects look like? What does good group communication or leadership look like? What are the sort of skills that they're looking for, that you're trying to instill into students with those types of projects? And that's the type of stuff that we're also looking at with the work that we do at CSIRO, particularly with the STEM Community Partnerships Program, where we're working with industry and educators to bring in real life problems into these schools that kids can actually contextualize and see that problem in their everyday life, and then be able to then go off and solve it. And so yet again, they're also within that sort of group project environment.
I liked your use of the term hazing there, even though you kind of pulled back from it, but it's not wrong, because it's that similar vibe of, I went through this. This is how the system works. It was, you know, I'm fine. You know, it's like my mother hit me and I didn't do me any harm. Like, it's not that different. You know, it's like, this is my experience of education. This is my experience of group work. That's how we do it. And it's really difficult to shift that, to steer that into more constructive processes, I think.
And particularly within education and outreach, where, again, well, the system, people think, oh, well, the system worked fine because I'm doing great and I've come out of it fine. It's like, well, how was it set up for you in that experience? Did you come from, again, a high, what's known as a high ICSEA school, where ICSEA is this... it's produced by ACARA, which is the Australian Curriculum Reporting Authority. I think I've got that right. And ICSEA is a value of socio-education economics economic index for schools. And so you can rate schools from the lowest percentile, from, say, bottom 1%, all the way up to the top 1%. And so, you know, for the schools that might be in that sort of top of echelon, and you've gone through that, then you've had those resources around you. You've had those teachers that aren't teaching out of field. You have role models around you. You have mentors, again, to look up to and go, this is what I aspire to be. And you go down the other end, which is actually where I'm from. I'm from the northern suburbs of Adelaide, where most of the people that you grow up around haven't finished high school, let alone gone off to do university. Yeah. And so what you are expected to be in society and where you choose to go after school is very limiting. Even in, I think, year 10, we were shown by the career advisor at the time that... And at the time, I was like, that's right. Like, why on earth would you say it like that? But being a little bit older now, I understand what he was trying to say. But he was like, hey, this is what you guys want to be able to do after school, but this is the ATAR that you need. And actually, no one in the school has achieved beyond this ATAR to go off and do this stuff. And at that point, it was a very sort of massive punch in the gut. And I think it would have probably been it could have been more palatable if there was a sort of better messaging around it. I think it was a bit sort of terse messaging, but I think he was just trying to say, like, please prep yourself because it is a hard road to get to where you are. And then even when I was in uni, I remember just passing my first year physics and math, and the head of astronomy at the time was like, hey, look, you should probably think about studying something else because your grades are probably not where they need to be. And so that's hard because, again, like, your education, the education system that you've grown up has limited you by that. And in particular, the environment you grow up around where you need to work 2-3 jobs in order just to get through uni at that time was challenging.
Messages from those two authority figures in your life make me so angry. That is so wrong.
I mean,
that's devastating.
Spite is a great motivator. And to go ahead and say, like, now I have a PhD in astrophysics and have helped discover a dozen planets amongst the cosmos, and now being able to use that data literacy to now be able to empower the STEM education and outreach ecosystem is amazing. But again, like, if you go out and say, well, this is all working well, it's like, well, is it really working? And more importantly, who is it actually working for? And, well, sorry, most importantly, who is it not working for? And what can we do about it? And actually, and I think in terms of the sort of questions around future questions that you have, of thinking about who your audience actually is and what do they need in order to lift themselves up, and what does success actually look like to them. And I think that's having that sort of humility and compassion within data is so important,
and the ability to look for what's not reflected in the data. So we talk about students going to university who are the first in their family to go to university. But it's a whole new level when it's the first in their community, the first in their school, the first, you know, like, that's, it's a level of, you know, that there are these levels of privilege that we don't even realize we can't see. You know, when you're swimming in it, you can't see your own privilege. And so, you know, I come from I'm the youngest of four, and everyone, my sisters all went to university. My mum didn't, but, you know, a lot of my relatives had. And so for me, it was just an assumption that I would go to university. For you, it was a real moonshot. And here you are with a PhD and changing the ecosystem. I I love that for you, but also, holy shit, that level of the barriers, the systemic barriers that we just don't take into account often enough.
But then it's also to recognize that privilege and everything is a spectrum, right? And that to say that, okay, there's a lot of barriers that I've had to face within that. But I also know as a white male that's 6'4", that comes with whole different levels of privileges which I haven't been able to come across. And yet the experiences of friends and family and others who aren't that, and listening to their stories, you feel the same way. And so I think it's a matter of also being around a diverse range of people and experiences, and particularly again when you're in this space trying to get as many diverse voices as you can, because again, if you're only sampling a certain cohort of students or a certain cohort of teachers or schools, and you go, all right, well, that's great, we can now apply this to all schools or whatever the case may be, and then you go, oh, actually, that's all fallen down in a heap, because my assumptions around what was going to work has all gone through. Like, a perfect example of that was when I was doing my master's in the science circus, we got to go out to remote communities in the territory, and the workshops that we created were for, we sort of test them out in schools in inner city Canberra. And so they all worked well. And then I remember the first community I went to was in Laramba, which is about 2.5 hours northwest of Alice. And it was sort of the classic bridge building exercise with spaghetti and tape and whatnot, and giving the kids sort of lowdown on what's going to happen. And one little fella puts up his hand and he goes, "What's a bridge?"
Whoa.
And of course, if you, like, the penny just dropped like that. And I was like, that makes so much sense. Like, there's barely any bridges in Alice. I mean, the poor Todd floods once in a blue moon type thing. Mm. And that was a real sort of, I wouldn't say earth-shattering, but like, that I really took the step back and thought about my own privilege in a way that I've never ever thought about before. And so, yeah, once we got out of that situation, we go, all right, we're going to go on to paper planes, or I think that's what we worked on instead, and the kids loved that. Then you go, okay, well, next time when we are going into a community space like that, well, what actually interests them? What are they into? How can you then actually wrap around? And this is what the research is showing as well with the work that we're doing. What if there's a local context in which kids can actually see themselves in, and it's relatable? It doesn't, and we've both had this discussion around, like, if it interests them, fantastic. And that's a boon within itself. But if you have that local context in which they can actually see that in their own environment, then they go, oh, this is great. I know how to actually now apply this, rather in this sort of real abstract way where kids are like, I have no idea how this relates to me. And particularly, like, how does a bridge relate to someone like myself, where I've got a little creek on this side of me and the nearest bridge from me is about 400 clicks away. So... yeah,
that's why I love those projects where kids are trying to solve problems in their own communities, you know, working on something that's meaningful to them and applying the skills that they need to figure that problem out and measure it and come up with solutions. And that's, you know, it's so scalable, but also so localizable. You know, it fits in any context. But even with that, you still, you know, you have to think about what the base level of skill you have in the classroom or in the group that you're dealing with, and you know, what kinds of conversations you're going to be able to have. It's no two groups are alike. It's one of the things I love about education. Like every time you run a course, it's a different beast with a different group of kids.
100%. And then so when you're on the back end of that data and trying to work out on trends or working out why this worked in this particular way, and you have these sort of real heterogeneous cohorts come in, then it's sometimes hard to work out, well, how come that landed? And then I did the exact same thing yesterday and I come in and that's different again. And like, yes, you can look at the broad distribution of results and go, all right, well, that's working, but then it also doesn't help you in the then and there and be like, well, why did that not land? But that's when we try and get some data on that group at that point in time to go, all right, well, what did you enjoy about it, or what did you get out of it? And I don't know, man, sometimes it's just the wind blowing in the wrong direction some days.
The moon's in the wrong phase, the planets are in the wrong alignment.
Mercury's in retrograde. We're all done for.
Definitely. Sometimes you just can't, it's just there's no knowing what happened on that day. Is that, you know, you work with data all the time and you're trying to communicate that and working with other people's data. Is there one thing that if everybody knew this particular thing about data, your life would be easier? Is there one thing you wish everybody knew?
That's amazing. That's a great question. Data is only as good as what's happening on the ground. So the data is a reflection within the work that we're doing of the great work that the people in the workshops are delivering, or the young kids at their virtual STEM visits to different industry locations or whatever the case may be. But then it's a matter of understanding, well, how was that data set up in the first place? And what type of picture is that data trying to paint? And what's actually missing from that? Particularly with data, you might have, say, a third of the jigsaw puzzle there and all the pieces that are from all of that jigsaw puzzle, and then you've got like sort of blotches and you try and work out, well, I'm trying to sort of fill in the gaps with the data set that I have. And in some cases, it's a good representation of what's going on, and sometimes it's not as clear. And that's because our instruments, whether it might be survey tools or interviews or case studies, like, unfortunately, what would be nice is that I could be a little fly on the classroom, in the classroom there and just observing what's going on, but we don't actually have the resources or, I guess, the ethics.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
I think our ethics board would look at that and go, no, that's not right. And then all that information all that time to then get through all of that information to then go, all right, well, is this now the full picture or not? And then also, you know, who designs the data systems that you have or are using, and what is their worldview and what biases are ingrained within those data structures again? And there's so much complexity around data, and even to the point of what you think might be a basic count or something like that is very contextual. So Laura said that data is like a conversation, and it's only as good as that conversation. And so, yeah, again, it's a matter of like, what types of questions are you asking? How are you answering that? How are you getting people to then answer those conversations? Are you getting them to just give a little box tick to say, all right, yep, that's done? And in most cases, a box tick tells you nothing about the complexity of an intervention or their experiences and their worldview. But then at the same time, you don't have the resources, or no one wants to sit there for an hour and be like, so tell me everything that you did and how you felt in every single moment in that workshop. No one's got that. No one's going to do that.
But also, you wouldn't get an accurate reporting from people anyway, because, you know, it's already been edited and processed in their own brains, and you get back something that's not actually what happened.
That's right.
Interesting aspect of working with data about people. I loved your point about data design too, because that is something that I think we really don't understand well enough. And I keep coming back to it, the idea that we actually design the data that we collect. So in the structure of the questions or the definition of, you know, what constitutes in or out, or what, you know, what the different categories are, all of those things completely change the story that the data tells. And we forget that they're there, and we forget that they have those, you know, the built-in worldview of the people who designed that.
Exactly. And then we're trying to get people to, you try and put boxes on a spectrum as well. And you go, all right, Well, do you fit into here and here and here? And then, especially with design, you work with a team and you go, all right, I reckon this is exactly what you need. And then you come back and eat humble pie because you go, oh, shivers, they're the groups of individuals actually lie in between these boxes or in completely different part of that spectrum. And again, it's a matter of, like, if you are working with teams, actually understanding on the ground what their needs and wants are and what they're actually trying to get out of this information. Yeah. So I think in terms of what you wish everyone knew about data is that it is complex.
I love that. In a nutshell, it's complicated. I think that, you know, you mentioned something about, you know, not being able to film the entire hour. And I think it sums up the complexity when you think that even if you did film it, it would be something that was off camera, or, you know, that you couldn't quite see from the angle of where the camera was pointing that it turns out you need to know. And I've lost count of the number of studies I've done, surveys that I've done, where I've got all of this rich data back, incredible numbers of questions and really great lens on the thing. And there's one thing that I should have asked that I only find out when I'm deep in the analysis and I go, oh man, I really need to know this thing that I didn't ask.
But that's the joy.
You don't know until you get to the end.
That's the great joy of what we're doing, though, is that it is dynamic and it science and data is a human endeavor. Yeah. And so you do learn through what you've done great, and then also what you opportunities to learn and do things better. And it's always like that. And I think some systems can be quite rigid in terms of, well, no, it needs to be perfect 100% of the time, and we need to have data that's 100% reliable. I'm going to tell you right now, there's no number that doesn't accurately reflect that picture, regardless of what number you look at, whether it's survey results, well, who were they actually surveyed, by who. Even something as fundamental as physics, you know, you're always going to get a distribution of particles. You're always going to get a probability of where an electron's going to be. You don't get a definitive answer on anything. And so we expect these really complex systems and approaches where you're only getting a little sliver of that information, where, again, you know, you might have your view down in one direction and actually all the juicy information was on the other side, and yet you have to distill down all of that to one number and go, that's the whole story. Now, that's not to say that everything you read is completely fabricated and wrong and misleading. That's not the case at all, but there's always nuance in what you're looking at, and then it's up to us as data stewards and as data scientists to give transparency on what people are seeing, how that number has been derived, what people that number actually represents in terms of the equity lens that I've been talking about, and what are people trying to, I guess, sell you with that number?
I love that essential point, which is that the real world is always messier than the textbook. You know, I found out recently that not everybody has the same number of arteries to their kidneys. And I was like, see, that's what, yep, that's the face I made.
Wow.
I was like, you know, I was having a scan and they were like, now we'll look for the accessory arteries. And I was like, the what now? Like, apparently, you know, even bodies, which we see all of these textbook pictures of, you know, and the heart is on the left. Not necessarily, as it turns out. There are this number of kidney arteries to the kidneys. Not necessarily, as it turns out. Like, it's we learn science and we learn about the real world in this sort of simple textbook
very
fashion.
Objective way.
Yeah. And then we hit the real world and it's nothing like the textbook and it's just mind blowing.
Yeah.
It's one of my big goals is to get education more like that, you know, that we're not teaching these sanitized versions of the real world. We're actually teaching about the real world.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite, before, again, coming over to CSIRO, I was working at Questcon, and one of the coolest exhibits I saw was that they had painted a color on one part on a wall, and then next to it there was a digital screen, and you had to fine tune the digital screen for the
Ooh.
Color on the digital screen to match up with the color on the wall.
Oh, and that's nice.
Everyone has a random distribution of cones in their eyes. People always, even though there is definitively that same color is still there, people are going to get slightly different answers to that color. And so that, even something as objective as a hex code that you have to then print out this color and people then interpreting that is completely subjective.
That's
and that's, again, the world that we live in, and the complexity. And I think it's a matter of being able to, have education in this way of that there is a lot of complexity, but within that complexity, there's a lot of exciting and beautiful things that are happening and things that we can contextualize, but in nuanced ways.
Yeah. You can't put kids, you know, the same kid in two different test tubes and only vary one, one thing, one factor. But it's much more interesting this way. It's much more interesting to look at real people and figure out what really does make a difference. I have completely lost my place in the questions.
You're okay.
It's been such a cool conversation.
I think we're at the datum stakes.
Yes, we are. What are the worst data mistakes that you've seen?
I mean, there's definitely mistakes that I've done in the past. and I guess one of the ones I have in my mind is we were working on a bunch of telescopes about half an hour outside of Toowoomba. And we've been working on this, discovering planets around this one particular star called AU-MIC, and the first discovery, well, it was leading to a Nature paper, which it was, and so I was like, oh my goodness, this is amazing. And then I was setting up the telescopes for a long night of just observing that one particular star, so you get set up at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon and don't finish till about 6 o'clock in the morning. Oof. And staring at that one little dot the entire night. And start going through the data and start having a look at it. And my God, oh my goodness, I reckon we found an additional planet around this star. And it was a really great discovery in terms of this star is such a young star, but yet it's the planet that we found isn't where it's supposed to be. And so it's a real sort of game changer in terms of how we understand how planets form and evolve. It should be around where Pluto is, but it was closer to a star than Mercury is to the Sun. And so we see this big dip and we go through and we go, oh my goodness, is that a second planet? And we go through all the data and have a look at it. And then it just looked textbook definition of what a planet around a star would look like. And that turns out it was Moonlight. And spent...
Oh. So Kat Ross had basically the same story, only in her story it was the sun. That there was this artifact that they couldn't figure out and eventually figured out it was the sun. I love these stories because the fact that you can be open about it and go, you know, sometimes you don't see the thing that is right in front of you or really obvious or much closer than another star.
Right in front of you. And, you know, Kat's a really dear friend of mine on sort of a personal note, she really got me on my journey of my neurodivergent journey, which was wonderful. So thanks, Kat, on that front. But yeah, you know, these things happen. You hear about those sort of happy accidents in terms of all these other discoveries, but then there's also not so happy accidents or mistakes that you see. So that was within myself. But I think in terms of mistakes in general, I don't think people are... In general, people aren't malicious. And I think I remember in 21, my mental health was a little bit hay going. I remember being in Brisbane. I was having a bit of a panic attack. Ring up one of my mates, say, hey, look, can I come over and hang out with you for a bit? And Amanda was like, yeah, sure. So come on over. And we were hanging out for a bit and took me to a back porch and got this table, and she just chucked down a paper and some pastels, and she's like, just draw.
Oh, nice.
Just draw. And so I was doing that, and you know, a few weeks go by and sort of continue drawing that thing, and I look at it and go, oh, that's great. And then I looked at what my mate was doing, and it was, mine looked like a 5-year-old's painting that a parent puts on the discouragingly or puts on the fridge to go, oh yeah, that's a great painting. And I was like, oh my god, how come mine doesn't look like yours? And she's like, you're a sausage, mate. Like, I've been doing this for I've been painting and been really involved in my art for years. You're like, this is what, the first thing you've done in almost a decade? I'm like, oh yeah, about that. She's like, well, why are you so hard on yourself? And I think, again, if you've had the privilege of going through an education and in data science and uplifting yourself and understanding of how things are, you're obviously going to spot things that people are maybe not even careless, or they don't actually know and understand. People don't know what they don't know type thing. And so I think it's up to yourself, as someone who has been privileged enough to go and get that education or to go and do that research or those learnings, to then go to your peers and not go, what are you doing, you silly sausage, but actually go, oh wow, that's actually really cool, can we have a chat about that? Or what do you think about this, and what could make it better? And actually bring people along for that journey, and yeah, and just have that sort of strength based approach, and understand that everyone's background is completely different and their skill levels are different. And instead of sort of putting people down, lift others up. And if you are seeing some mistakes in the data, whether it might be sort of, a lot of it is probably human error anyway, someone's put in a 9 instead of a 6 or whatnot, which is, that can happen to anyone type thing. And so I think most people are just trying to do their best. And if you're in a position where you can build up people's skills and capabilities so they're not making those mistakes, whether it's big or small, then that's what you should be, that you should be doing in your role. And if you have the capacity to do so, then why wouldn't you do it?
I love that. That's beautiful. That's such a heartfelt teacher moment. That's you're a natural born teacher. That's beautiful. So have you ever, it sort of almost flies in the face of what you just said, but have you ever seen data deliberately misused? Is there something where you say, oh, that was beyond the pale?
I mean, you do, and whether in most cases you have, and again, got the literacy to understand why people are doing that, and in particular, it's most likely on as a advert or in socials or or whatnot, where people are trying to sell you something, and again, watching for the signs or looking at one who was that intended for. What's the actual motive behind this data or these numbers? Is it just the fact of trying to create a diversion or to split people apart rather than sort of bring people together? Who's actually paying for that study or paying for those numbers to be presented in that way? And so I think a lot of that, again, is just a matter of what are people's motivations behind those numbers, and for you to recognize that. But then it also comes again with that privilege of that education and background and understanding, and in particular with AI, where things online are becoming more and more real, where someone like myself, who's come from this background, does data for a living and has been slipped up a couple of times and goes, that looks believable. I'll share that with a mate of mine, and they're like, nah, that's not right at all. Like, that's AI. I'm like, how on earth is that? Like, if I've been tripped up on that, and I'm pretty careful. So if I'm having difficulty then how is the average punter doing? And I think that's really, really troubling. But
it is.
I think it's more, again, the understanding and nuance of what definitions are and mean. And sort of in the evaluation space, we use sort of outputs to maybe be recognized as outcomes or as impact. And, you know, we often mistake measurement for meaning. You know, we might count participation or track outputs or the number of number of papers we've published, and we go, all right, well, that's impact. And it's like, well, or is it? Like, that's more of an output than an outcome. Like, what have those findings actually been able to achieve from you publishing that, rather than just going, oh, well, that's a box tick, we've got this number out there. So I think it's a matter of, again, in sort of the data and evaluation space, how can we get people to know the difference and nuance within those definitions, and for when we say impact, this is what it means? Or, you know, even in the public space, where people say, oh, well, I have a theory, and, you know, a theory in the sort of public space means something completely different in the scientific concept, and yet we use those words interchangeably. And so it's a matter of sort of how can we make sure that when we are talking about this, that there's a concrete definition behind it that the other person behind me then understands. But it's also, again, the complexity of and the nature of what we do, and the work that really excites me that we've been doing at the CSIRO is working with the University of Technology Sydney's HTI team around looking at sort of longitudinal studies and actually understanding, well, people come from these sort of real complex backgrounds of, you know, different school types, different attitudes towards STEM, different socioeconomic status, different sense of belonging in STEM and whatnot. And so if you have all these factors together, what is actually the most important in terms of actually changing the dial of people wanting to pursue a career in STEM. And so using sort of these really complex Bayesian analysis models to then go, well, this is what, in the general case, this is how people sort of fit. And, you know, lo and behold, your parents' background and economic background is sort of the fundamental part of that. And you can actually see in these beautiful graphs that you, different levers need to be used for different cohorts. So for boys, you're confident, their confidence is first, rather than the girls, their attitude precedes confidence. And so it's then, you know, using that information to then go, all right, well, these are the different interventions that we need to then be creating and curating and being delivering to these cohorts if we actually want to move the dial. And go, sort of going back to that whole, you know, well, a one size fits all type approach, where no one size, there's no such thing as the average person. Yep. And
yes.
I think that's more so in data, where we think about the average or the mean, and we go, all right, well, if it works in that center, we're fine. Where else, I think the work that we're doing at CSIRO is really, really exciting in terms of actually understanding, well, if we want to go into regional schools and we want to be working with young women and we want to be able to show them what careers look like and want them to pursue a STEM career, how we do it, this is actually the evidence-based way to go.
That's beautiful. I love that. So that's what excites you about your work in general. What excites you about data?
Oh, my goodness. It's just the endless stories. It's just the endless stories that data can actually tell you. And I love solving problems. I've always been that kid who always asks why. And particularly around, you know, having a research background and now work in evaluation, there's a fantastic evaluation extraordinaire, E. Jane Davison, who has a fantastic quote around that research can tell us what so, but only evaluation can tell us so what. And so being able to utilize data that can actually tell you the what so, but then also the so what, to then be able to give that information to the people on the ground to actually affect change and work on changing the implementation of the work that they're doing to then proceed for better outcomes for young Australians to pursue a career in STEM is really, really amazing. And I'm really grateful to be in the position that I'm in to be able to do this as, again, as a living, and being able to grab that information and not just see the data as just lines and rows in a data table. It's a matter of like every, that's sort of that sonder around the data, that every line there is an individual throughout their own journey, and this is just a small snapshot of them. And how can we then use that information and the data that they've given us to actually empower them further to create the change and be the people that they're destined to be, rather than sort of capping them because of the inherent systematic barriers that are affecting them. So that's what I think really excites me about the work, about data, is just being able to find out someone's story, even if it's just a little snapshot, and then again, how can we then use that to empower themselves or empower others that are coming through through those STEM workshops or industry visits or teacher workshops to then empower them further.
I love that. It is, and we talked about this before, that it is such a privilege to be able to work in a space where you know what you do matters and it's meaningful, and to apply your skills in that way. It's been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful to have you here. Dr. Jake Clark, thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Make Me Data Literate, a podcast from the Australian Data Science Education Institute. Check out the rest of our work to build critical thinking, data literacy, and AI literacy at adsy.org. See you next time.